Easement agreement with PJ DeCaris Company, Olympia Street, Amon.
Good evening. Just a couple of comments on the bond, if I could, real quick. Cynthia Weed, who you met tonight, is the premier bond legal counsel in the state. She is called all over the nation to do bonds for everybody. I did my first bond with her 26 years ago, and she is just the best. So we can feel very confident in the work that she did for us. Also, the conservative nature of the city council in adopting the budget and the amount of reserves that we do have, that enabled us to get that A-plus rating. So thanks to the council and being conservative also. You have before you, the question is, will you allow the mayor to sign an easement agreement with PJ DeCaris Company or his representative relative to the north side of Olympia Street? The purpose of this easement is to acquire the rights and ability to pave the north half of Olympia Street from 4th Avenue to 7th. I've forgotten the estimated cost. Well, the project bid for that part of it is $130,000. The easement agreement that you have before you is a standard agreement approved by our city attorney. There is one part of it that I would like to highlight. Councilmember Kaler and I discussed this earlier today. It's really the last paragraph on the second side. Again, this is a standard easement agreement. The last paragraph talks to the point that Olympia Street, which this easement enlarges and relates to, is improved with payment. The grantee, City of Othello, shall bear all costs that improvements, and the grantor shall be responsible for none of these costs. I want to make sure the council understands that the city pays for everything. Now, the north side of Olympia Street has not been paved previously because the owner, when the south half was paved, declined to pave the north half, to pay for the north half. So we are now, years later, on behalf and benefit to the citizens of Othello, particularly those that live there, we're paving the north half. This means that we cannot go after a future developer, and that's a question Mr. Kaler had today. All payments are done with this instrument. We do not have an agreement that says a future developer will reimburse the city back, and the city attorney and I have talked about this at length today, trying to figure out how the wordage and what the verbiage means. It means exactly what it says. The City of Othello shall bear all costs of that improvement, and the grantor, PJ DeCaris, shall be responsible for none of the costs for such pavement. So the city is bearing all costs relative to this project, and there is no way of obtaining reimbursement except for future improvements. If we put curb, gutter, and sidewalk in, or have other improvements relative to the property, then we can ask a future developer to help pay for that. But this paving, which does not include sidewalks and curb, is the city's nickel. So with that, I would ask the city council to approve, motion to approve the easement with PJ DeCaris and allow the city, the mayor, or his delegate to sign the easement agreement.
Any questions? Freeman?
I have, back to basics, is an easement, is DeCaris actually giving us this land, or what is it already ours, or what's the status
of
it?
No, it's an easement. All city roads, all abutting property owners own to the center of that road.
Yeah, 20 feet from property owner?
Right, yeah. Right. So we have it to use as a city street for as long as we want. But if we ever, say, abandon the street, it goes back to the abutting property owner.
But they can't take it, just randomly take
no,
it back?
They don't have that power. Cities do, but they don't.
Okay.
By the way, the easement has a double plus ratings, according to Standard & Poor's. We have a good document.
What about sidewalk and curb on that side? Does that require another easement to get more land? Or
if it requires more land, yes. But again, that is contingent upon platting and the development of that property.
So
that
so
would be required of the city to give that.
But if they put property on the other side, there'd be an automatic 13-foot easement there, as
yes,
with all property.
Okay.
That's the question that I had with Eamon is because, you know, what happens down the road or in the future, I didn't want to open up a can of worms that we start doing this for future developers to come in and say, well, I'm going to build a half street, you're going to build the other half. And that's not quite right, but if this is the only way we can get it done, we've still got the right to collect for the curb and gutter and sidewalks whenever they complete that or whatever the future build out on that north side. So, so that was my big question and concern, be sure that we don't lose at least that portion of it.
And the other side of that is, of course, you have passed an ordinance that says there will be no more half streets, so this situation won't occur again.
Yep.
We did something like that on Columbia where we paid, the city paid for, the developer was only, had to do so much, but the city wanted it done.
Yeah, that was like an oversight. Yeah. Yes, that was at our request, so we paid for the oversight.
Yeah.
Okay, Joy.
I think that particular one, we've got a chance to come back and collect that money in the future.
We do as a city. Mm-hmm. We have no restrictions relative to time frames to come back. Like a developer has a 15-year restriction to get reimbursed. Cities go on forever.
Right. So do I hear a motion to authorize the mayor to sign the easement agreement with P.J. DeGaris Company for Olympia Street?
Make that motion.
Mark Snyder?
I'll second.
Okay. Second. Gina? Any more discussion? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same? Okay, that passes.
Thank you.
Well, five update. Is that you again, Eamon?
Well, I'd like to introduce Larry and Jennifer Goldmark. You remember Taylor Danny.
Yeah.
They have, as recently as this afternoon, had discussions with Chris Snyder, the well driller. The discussions council wanted to hear are, what are the options relative to well number five? What do we do with it? What's the status of it? Where do we go from here? Put in a submersible, rehabilitate the existing well, abandon the well, or drill a new well? And they're going to review those options with you. After you see the video of the well five well.
Mr. Mayor and Council, thank you. Chris Schneider sends his regrets. He could not be here tonight from Schneider Equipment. He had a prior pressing engagement he could just not get out of. But as Eamon said, we did have lengthy conversations, not only with him, but with Public Works crew today, looking at Well 5 and what the different options could be. Taylor is queuing up a video inspection that Schneider Equipment did once the well equipment was pulled out of the hole. And it goes down 600-700 feet. Basically, it shows a hole in the ground. We don't want to bore you with all that, but there is one particular area at about 360 feet below ground surface, BGS, that's one of the buzzwords, below ground surface, that is a little bit of a problem that will need to be taken care of should council decide that they do want to rehabilitate or reuse this particular well. The options we've looked at are, as Eamon was saying, can we reuse the existing hole? If so, what are the options involved? Can we get the 1,500 gallons a minute out of basically the hole in the ground that the city has been able to get in the past, and how to do that? If not, what are the options? And how does that compare to drilling a brand new well, complete with brand new everything? And as Taylor's working on that, we've looked at the condition of the hole. Not only did Schneider do a video inspection, they did an alignment test. Because one of the concerns was, do we have a plumb well? Is it within tolerances? Or just what's happening below ground? The well itself is or has a problem at about 250 feet below ground surface. It does take a hook, if you will, kind of a dog leg. And in the first 30 feet past the around 220 feet below ground surface, it's out of alignment by about 5 inches. We won't be able to tell from looking at the video, but from the testing that they did, it does show that there is an alignment problem. And after discussions with the driller and with city crew, everyone has basically come to the consensus that's one of the major issues why the shaft keeps breaking. Looking at a little history of the well was first drilled in 1973. The first time that the shaft broke was in 1998. It was broke again in 2007 and broke again in 2010. So after 1998, when the shaft broke, it broke about 9 years later and then broke again 3 years later. So not only is it continuing to be a problem, but it sounds or it looks like it's increasing in frequency. Taylor, why don't you go ahead and, if you would, explain what we're looking at.
Okay. So right here, you're obviously at 361.2 feet. On the left-hand side of the picture is a half of a column. Something you can't see all that well, but you'll see better in a minute, is right above the left, top left-hand corner of the zero, there's a piece of galvanized pipe that's wedged down between your bigger size casing and where it goes to a smaller 16-inch casing. And that collar is sitting behind that piece of galvanized pipe. And in talking with Schneider, it's their opinion that this collar is what was wedging the tool, the pump, and everything down there at the bottom of the hole. And then as they got it pulled up, it fell free and fell down to this point. If you'll watch the video here, go down. You're seeing a bottom vision out the camera. It's going to go down a couple feet and then rotate around the edge of the casing, and you'll get a better view of what's there. The water you're seeing dropping down is from a hose that we put at the top of the well to keep the light of the camera cool.
It also helps with making what you're seeing more visible, because anytime you disturb water in a well like this, the incrustations you see around the coupler are going to start sloughing. So by putting water down into it, it allows the water to settle and you can see better. And no, this is not the movie Aliens.
Did the casing go that deep, or did it stop and start up again?
We think it's continuous.
Wow.
So right there, you're looking at the lip between the two different sides of the casing. Right there is your collar. That's the piece of pipe that is wedged behind. That's something that will have to be removed before anything. To rehab the well or pump those back in the well, Schneider or someone will have to go in there and remove that, which they think they can do, but it's something that will need to be done before the next step is taken from the well.
Even if we do a submersible?
Mm-hmm. There is one caveat to that. If we put a much smaller diameter pump, shaft, etc. back in, we may be able to get past the hook in the well at 250 feet, or in the casing, and the obstruction at 360. And we'll get into that in just a minute here. It's not uncommon to see tubing such as that down in a well. The tubing is used quite often because you want to send recording devices or probes down into the well to see what level your water's at. Or say, for example, in the case of well 6, to test at different levels so we can determine exactly where fluoride is or other chemicals. So it's quite often you'll see tubing like that. Typically it doesn't get stuck at a coupling or break off and wrap itself around the bearings, but it's pretty prevalent to see things like that.
The rest of the video, there's really not much
We're pleased to say there are no alligators in the water. I don't know about the sewer, but...
Any debris or leftover scrap at the very bottom from the...
There is a little bit from that coupling that was dislodged. Chances are we can leave it the way it is. I don't think we have to do anything to fill in at the bottom. We should be okay.
Does council want to see more of the video, or is just the troubled area enough?
We can get you copies if you'd like. If anyone has insomnia.
Well, it sounds like sounds like we've seen what we need to see.
Okay.
So.
If you feel comfortable with it, why?
Yeah. In working with Schneider and the city crew, we think that's the most telltale point right there. It'd be nice to be able to say at 250 feet below ground surface, we can see a misalignment, but it's just something that's difficult to even look at. So where do we go from here? We've looked at different possibilities. Public Works crew really wants to stress that this is a high producer for the city, 1,500 gallons a minute. We're coming into the summer months, high consumption. In fact, last weekend they had to fire well 6 up a little bit just to meet demand. And it's, as summer progresses, as we all know, there's just going to be more demand. If we can't get 1,500 gallons a minute, obviously they'd like to see a new well. We think we can get 1,500 minutes back with this well, but it's going to take a little bit of effort and a few other items besides just a new well and pump. Some of the issues we believe are the problems in talking with the driller and city crews, the misalignment of the hole. Whenever the pump turns on and off, there's a surge. Not as much as saying there's a water hammer, but there is a surge. And we think that has caused some of the downhole problems as far as the shaft goes. Now, we've been told that both in 5 and 6, when the column came out of the hole, they could see that the brackets were loose, or the couplers that held the column together. I don't know if that's a result of the surge or the vibration of the pump turning on and off, or possibly when it was last pulled and inspected, it just wasn't tightened sufficiently. I don't know if we'll ever know, but I think a good conscious effort of watching the contractor to make sure when it does go back in that it's tightened down wouldn't hurt. There's no low amperage cutout in the controls. So if the shaft does break, there's nothing in the controls that tells the pump to shut off. So in this last case here, just a couple months ago, shaft broke, pump kept spinning, causing more of a problem, more of a breakage. So in the controls, if we don't go with a VFD, a variable frequency drive, to take care of the surges, then definitely we'd need at least a low amp cutout. And of course the shaft keeps breaking. That could be a combination of issues. Part of it is with just the misalignment, the shaft rubbing up against that point in the casing, we think has caused part of that problem. As far as rebuilding the existing well versus a new well, basically a new well is going to be in the $1 million range. The city's budgeted for that for a new well number 9. So any new well in the 1,500 gallon a minute range is probably going to be right around there. If we can reuse part of the well house that's there now, that cost would come down, obviously. By rebuilding the existing well, if we put in a submersible with a variable frequency drive, soft start, the low amp cutout, putting the pump back down at this about 700 foot level where the good water producing zone is, 300 horsepower motor, which is comparable with what's in there now, we believe that the city could get probably around 1,200 gallons a minute. That's a reduction from the 1,500, but the drillers feel that that's a good, comfortable number. That cost, total project cost, including all the time the contractor would be involved, it includes some cleaning of the screens and the perforations. That incrustations I was talking about, there is some buildup on the screens now, but it's not bad. A little bit of rehab work should also clean up some of those open holes. We're probably talking in the range of $250,000 to $290,000. If we went with a vertical turbine pump, and of course the difference is where the motor is in comparison to the rest of the equipment, with the same VFD, across the line soft starter, 700 foot level, if we went back with a 350 horse motor, which is actually what's in there now, same size pump, shaft, column, yes, it's going to rub, but we believe everyone's right that we would get the 1,500 gallons a minute. The caveat there is, in 3 years, you'll probably be replacing it. If you just want to figure that in as an O&M item, the vertical turbine would be the way to go. That cost, vertical turbines are a little more expensive, we figure it would be in the $325,000 to $375,000 range. Another possibility would be if we just used well 5 as a backup well, put in a much smaller diameter pump motor shaft column so that it misses both of the obstructions at the 250 foot misalignment and at 350 feet if we can't get that tubing out of the way. So basically it would be a straight up and down aligned motor and column. The drawback is we'd probably be looking at a reduction of about half. So we'd be in the 600 to 700 gallons a minute of available water. You know, this is just conjecture at this part, at this point, but from discussions with the driller, our experience in wells, talking to Public Works crew, we think that's where it would end up. The cost to do that, a much smaller scale model, what's there now, would probably be in the $125,000 to $150,000 range. But one thing to point out, that greatly reduces the amount of water available, and we would strongly recommend immediately going and finding land for the new well number 9 to replace it, even if it's across the street from well 5. In a nutshell, those are the options that we have looked at, the investigations, if you will, of what we think has caused the problem and why, and the view of both the driller and the Public Works crew. A lot to take and absorb, but if there's any questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
I'm a little surprised at the number going to a smaller column, only 125,000, because on that you have to replace the column, the shaft, the motor, everything. Mm-hmm. And you can do all that for 150,000?
We believe so. It does not include the VFD or the across the line starter. We would suggest the low amp cutout. And with a much smaller, much more available equipment, the cost is considerably less. And one thing I forgot to mention, timing. Drilling a new well can take upwards of a year, particularly with Department of Ecology involvement, water rights, transferring between points of withdrawal.
I don't know if this is out of the box or not, but to me, you have the hole there that's 99% complete and has a little bend in it. Tear the building off, get everything out of there, and just re-drill. In modern technology, you can drill a straighter hole, re-drill the same hole.
That's a possibility. We could do that. That would add to the cost of whatever size pump motor goes back in there. What it would do is alleviate the need to replace things in 3 years. It would take to put in a rehabilitated well 5, either vertical turbine or submersible, probably take about 2 months. So there's a considerable time savings by rehabbing 5 versus drilling a new well.
Have you heard of that being done before?
Yes. It can be done.
Yeah.
But didn't Snyder say that, it can be done, but it's so expensive, it's cost prohibitive?
I think it'll follow the same route.
There's also a chance that if the existing steel casing comes apart, it could lodge down in the bottom of the hole, and you're looking at fishing out parts and pieces of that again. But it can be done.
I got a couple things here, Tim. Looking at this thing here a little bit, I was in talking to Eamon, and we kind of drew a picture of this whole thing. What I can't quite understand, you know, basically we got the same hole that we had in there 30 years ago or 40 mm-hmm. years ago, whenever it was cut. How come that first pump lasted 25 years before anything happened to it? After we put it in, after that time, we only get 6 or 7 years out of it.
It's a very good question, and we don't know. We've asked ourselves that. We've asked the crew that. We've asked the driller that. Nobody knows.
I mean, it was years ago. It wasn't uncommon to have crooked holes.
Sure.
And a lot of pumps were operated out of those. They're still operating today. And we're talking about here, even to say we only get 7 years out of that. What about our submergible pump? We got less than 3 years out of the one that we put in well number 4 up here. Mm-hmm. So I think you got to take that into consideration, as well as you're pumping a heck of a lot less water out of it.
Yeah.
So that creates a problem there. And
what we had envisioned when we talked about the submersible was it would be a little bit smaller than what's in the hole now, or the vertical turbine that would go back in at the existing size. And the trade-off there is we think about 300 gallons a minute, which with a new well probably is not that big of a deal, but without it at peak critical summertime production demands, it could mean quite a bit of difference.
When we looked at well number 4, I don't think that we could get a submergible pump to go down there 700 feet and do that kind of work. That's why we went with a smaller pump down at, 450 feet or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think we'd have the same problem with this. I think we should stay with a turbine pump so that we get the maximum production out of that, and so it costs us more money. At least we got it's the same thing as drilling 2 wells and put 2 submergibles in there. You're going to take at least that much to get the same capacity of water.
Yep.
But we already got the hole drilled.
Eamon, I got a question for Eamon. This well is insured through our city insurance carrier.
Mm-hmm.
Since the shaft or the couplers broke, is it covered under the policy?
They're currently evaluating. They've sent an adjuster out to take a look, and we haven't heard back from them.
Okay, and then if they agree that it is a covered, what do they base their payback on? Is it on what particular way we go, or how are they going to base on how much they're going to
remember? Insurance is to make you whole again the way you were, so that's what they would attempt to do. They would pay us to put us back the way we were.
The way we were. So they're going to base it off putting the turbine back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Could we do one other thing too while we're thinking about whatever we're going to do with this well? When they screw this thing back together with the couplings and whatnot, we sometimes think maybe one of them come unscrewed or whatever. Why can't they tack weld those couplings as they go down? When they're finished with them, just tack weld those things. And that could always be cut off later if you got to pull that out.
Yeah.
And that'll solve a lot of this problem that you've got with with them coming unscrewed or whatever.
I think you've hit on a very good point there, Ken. Typically, they don't do that so that in the future, when you do need to pull it out, you don't have to cut everything apart, but chances are, if it lasts a good long lifetime, you're going to have to cut the couplings apart anyway, just because it gets encrusted so much. It could easily be added into a specification to do that.
One of the options, and this is what actually Dan Quirk's recommendation for Public Works is, if you have a column, which are the outside lines, and you have a deviation, which is here, and that's the 5-inch offset that you were talking about. What Dan said we did with well 3 years ago was, and remember, everything is up out of the hole now. So you would cut this here and cut it here,
and put a smaller tube from here to here and here. So it'd be like a Venturi effect. We have the large tube here that would go small and then large again. And Dan said that when we did that with well 3, and this would be a sort of reconstruction of well 5, that we lost no volume, but we lost only 3 psi. So even though the Venturi effect increases the speed of the water, we don't lose the volume, and we only lost a small psi. So this was one of the options you were talking about. Okay, just kind of put it in a diagram.
I don't get how that works with the shaft going through there and those spiders all the same size.
You basically, in a case like that, you typically would not have the spiders. You wouldn't have the downhole tubing that you would use, say, in a well where you've got the luxury of a hole of the same size all the way down. So that, I think, would be one of the trade-offs to going with either a reduction like that or in putting the same size equipment that we have in there now and having it rub up against the side of the casing.
So how do you run a shaft without the spider? Is it just freewheeling in there?
No, it's, according to the drillers, they can do it. It's not easy. It adds to some of the cost. I've not seen it done, to be honest,
yeah,
Mark.
That sounds...
The guy that does the drilling for his livelihood says they can do it.
So is it possible, is there different grades of metal for the shaft that we could put something around that one area that's a lot harder?
That might be
that
a possibility,
area?
Yeah.
And could that be a thought? Or
sure.
Just put something there that's, I don't know what the hottest metal is, I don't know, but you know, just that one area, if we decide to go that route. So
a different grade?
Out.
A different grade of steel or something like that?
Yeah, whatever. I don't know what it would be.
Yeah.
But.
Tend to look at a hardox steel.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing, or a bearing or something at that point.
Yeah, because they know where it needs to be, so.
And they just started being able to bend it.
So we'd have to pay a little bit more for that one area, but the rest of the thing, couldn't it be just the cheaper grade or whatever they use for wells? I don't know.
Okay. They're all very good ideas.
Yeah.
If you don't put the spiders in, that then there, I assume there's no support around the shaft, so that makes it longer. So if there's any kind of vibration to it, it just multiplies it because
yep.
It's longer up. So
I think so.
If with the spiders you're going to get a half inch, and if you don't have them, you're going to have 2.5 inches of flop.
Yeah. They may be able to do something where they've got a little bit of control in there. Again, I've not seen it done that way, to be honest. That's something that we need to explore in more detail just to make sure we don't have something freewheeling in there, which has, I think, been one of the problems in the past.
Sean, did you have a thought there? You had your hand up?
Back to the comment about maybe using harder steel. It may be, it's kind of a counterintuitive thought, sometimes harder steel puts stress on the surrounding structure. So it's a great question. I want to go for something soft. I've been questioning in my mind the last 20 minutes if stainless steel would be a viable replacement versus the galvanized pipe that's down there. But I'm not a well guy, and I'm having a hard time just wrapping my brain around it. But those are some questions. You would probably want to use something along the lines of maybe a 304 stainless steel or something in the 300, 400 glass, something
yep.
that's marine grade that's corrosion resistant.
Yep.
Electrolysis eating away and hitting and causing all kinds of problems like that.
Yep.
Those are just some
good idea. 304, 316 are both good materials. Readily available too. Thank you. Another good idea. All items that we want to explore before we turn any contractor loose.
One other question. What are the whole beers? The question I have is, geologically in that neighborhood, that far, you're talking about the depth of a football field down below
Well, that's okay.
It's not a question, I wonder if it's just, one of those moving parts.
These are all valid questions. We don't know if there's anything specific to the Well 5 site. The city does have other wells that are drilled to this depth or greater that doesn't seem to have had the problems, but I think a quick review of the geology of the area, we could answer, or at least look at that.
What is the lifespan on the submersible pump?
Elsewhere or the city of Othello? Sorry. Sorry, Gina.
That's okay.
I got one more thing too, Larry. I think that we should look at it for variable speed on that thing, so that thing starts out slow and turns, so we don't get that quick action, when you turn it on or shut it off, so you don't get that quick twisting of that. And I think that would help a lot of that problem too.
Definitely. And in answer to your question, Gina, I think a well could last a good 20, 30 years.
Submersible?
If it's properly maintained.
Submersible?
Yeah.
And you said that submersible 300 horsepower would be 1,200 gallons per minute?
That's what we're estimating. Okay. After discussions with the driller and with the crew.
Would the column be the same diameter with the submersible? Did they address that?
They did not, but it's probably going to be a little smaller.
So what do you do with the old column? They just scrap?
Scrap it.
I already have.
What's the downside? We talk about these starting, stopping problems. Why don't you run a 1,200 gallons per minute submersible and run it steady instead of 1,500 and turn it on and off? Is there any downside to running them full time?
It wears out quicker, and hydraulically, the city wouldn't need that much water in the winter time, so it would go to overflow in the tanks and just be wasted. And the Department of Health is really cracking down on conservation. One of the things they look at in water system plans, which we're in the process of updating for the city right now, is how much water is wasted. And they'll really come down on the city if there's a situation like that can be controlled some other way.
I'm not as familiar with submersibles, but can you do the variable drives and all that on a submersible?
I believe so, yes.
The flow rate really isn't a big issue with me, because in theory, if we rehabilitate number 6, we'll have 2,500 to 3,000 gallons per minute coming on that we really don't utilize now. So what if it only pumps 1,200 a minute? Kick on 6 when it gets rehabilitated.
1,200 is it pumps 1,500 now? 1,200 gallons per minute is not going to be much different. It's not going to make that big a difference.
Yeah, that's an estimate on our part. In talking with the crew, they really wanted to stress that in the summertime, by not having the water available, there is concern over whether they'll be able to meet the demands.
What? Tell me that again. With well 6?
No, just the way it is right now.
Oh. I don't understand that.
Well, they've been working without well 6.
Okay.
Well 5. So, I guess we need more information.
This is informational tonight to at least let you know where things are right now. What we've done since the last meeting. There's still, I think, some unanswered questions. We're a little closer to understanding what's gone on and why, but we don't have all the answers, I'll be honest.
The one problem that I see is that we've got a problem with time, and we've got a problem with the water issue. I mean, we've got a high demand coming up here shortly when the processing plants begin to operate again. And the question is, we can use well number 6, probably, possibly. Yeah. But if we shut that down, then we're in trouble. Mm-hmm. And that's our intent. And I think we've got to look at it grant money-wise to see what we can do as far as well number 6 with that amount of money to improve that, to make it happen. So we're kind of catch 22 here again to make it work.
The grant for rehabbing well 6 It does not need to be spent until about November, so we have time there on our side. The crew has said that they are really hesitant to take six completely offline, especially with five down and coming into the summer, which yeah. we can understand.
I understood you, Ken, to say the intent is to take well six offline. I don't agree with that. I mean, to rehab it, but to me, the intent is it's going to be a viable well pumping over hopefully 2,000 gallons per minute.
Mm-hmm. No, but what I'm saying is, how long can we go with that grant money to be acceptable to reevaluate or redo our well number six?
Right now, it's through November.
Yeah. So
we can't ask for an extension. And typically, they've been granted in the past. We could probably get another year if we wanted to.
Okay.
Well, if we can get a submersible to last 20 years, according to Stoker or whoever, it's going to be dried up by then anyway. So.
Don't worry about it.
I just am leaning towards submersible right now. I'll throw that out. That just sounds like if you can get a submersible to run steady, sounds good to me.
Vertical turbines are going to be probably 25-30% more money than a submersible. We could look at a submersible size approximately where we are now, a 350 horse, maybe even go a little larger to see if that can offset the problems we have downhole and see if we can get close to the same size shaft and column that we have in there now. I think that would get us a lot closer to the 1500. But these sizes and numbers were just to give you a range of possibilities.
So a submersible, 1,200 gallons, huh? That's not too bad, it seems to me.
Submersible in the range of maybe a 350 horse, down at the same level, 700 feet, approaching the 1,500 gallon a minute range, is probably going to be in the low 300s.
About fuel or electricity consumption, are they about the same?
Should be fairly close, especially right. If we put a VFD on it, variable frequency drive.
And the other alternative is just take everything we have and just drop it down there again.
Yes.
Why is the column shot now? We can't reuse our column?
It's not salvageable. They had to burn it to get it apart.
How about the shaft? Is it toast?
Yeah. Toast.
It's non-salvageable. Oh, so, okay.
Well, was everything new 3 years ago when we put it down there?
Sorry?
Was everything new 3 years ago when we put it down there? Or?
I don't believe it was at that time.
It
might have been in 93 when it was first put in.
In 07, broken shafts.
And we redid it in 05.
The shaft, there was some column pipe replaced. The spiders and bushings were replaced also in 07.
What we need from council is a direction on what you want to pursue and authorization to. We're running the bill up every time we take an action. So. We need to know what direction you want to go, and we can pursue that. You can give us a limit, or if you can just give us authorization, we'll be back next Monday night. However you want to do it, whenever your comfort zone is.
How much have we got in this thing already? Just offhand.
I'd have to look at the budget, yeah.
Okay. I think I agree with you, Mark. I think a submersible, to me, would be the option. We're only losing possibly 300 gallons.
Especially since we can get it with the variable drive so that it won't have those problems.
A submersible would be cheaper to operate than a turbine electricity wise. But I do need to tell you, after spending most of the day with the Public Works crew looking at this issue, they do not support a submersible.
I would look really hard at it. I think we need both of those issues looked at very well.
Okay.
And see where we're at on it. It looks like we're looking at $300,000, no matter however we look at it.
Either way, yeah.
Whatever you do.
Hate to say that, but it looks like that's the figure we're talking about, plus or minus another 50.
Not an easy pill to swallow, to be sure.
Well, we're in hopes of the insurance hopefully coming back to make us where we were at, which might be 152.
Larry, if we projected this another week to next Tuesday night, actually, mm-hmm. what could you have more for the council in a week? What information could you give them to help them make a decision?
Probably a harder number than the range we've been talking about, because this came from discussions just in the last day or so and today with the well driller, Schneider Equipment. And it was basically, let's crunch some numbers, give a range of where we think it's going to be to let the council know the different parameters. We can look more fine-tuned the numbers for both a submersible or a vertical turbine in the range that we've been talking about and see what happens.
The two comparisons I'd personally like to see is one, the submersible, and two, the Dan Quick method, where they taper it down. If he says that's working on three, and the weld guy says they can do that, that sounds viable to me if we can get around that bend by just tapering it down a little bit.
On that Venturi type two, I would like to know, are they going to stabilize it in the hole where it's larger and then just leave it free form where it's smaller?
Okay, we'll find that out.
Can have that ready by next Tuesday?
Sure.
Okay.
Is there any way
the
to
reason
stabilize?
We're trying to get this expedited is our issue with water and time.
Can we get some information about why Public Works is has an opinion one way, what they've seen.
Yeah, what do they have against submersibles besides a bad experience up there at four?
If you're talking about stabilizing that shaft, and you can stabilize it in the narrowing place and up above, how can you stabilize the bottom where it's bigger again? The bottom of your stabilization would be at the bottom of the smaller pipe then. So how many feet do you have to go there? 400?
Probably about that, yeah.
Yeah, but in thinking about it, I mean, you're putting those spiders in every piece of column, so what if you just reduce the spiders during the narrow section?
Well, that's what Dan is suggesting.
Exactly.
Is that they would have spiders below that section and above that section.
Just not in that section.
Right.
So,
and how?
Actually, what he's suggesting is maybe 30, 40 feet if we can get away with that.
That just would be unstabilized.
Of restricted.
Right.
Hmm.
So there should be 30, 40 feet that wouldn't have the spiders.
Correct.
Can you still put those spiders below that area, though?
That's
sure.
What he was saying.
Yeah. Okay.
That was my question.
Yeah.
Good question. We can have these put together for
just that. So you know, in well three, there's about 100 feet of area where there is no spiders, and that's been working for about 3 years, from what I understand from Dan. So we're hoping to reduce that length and still have the same effect of having it work. And again,
how come you just don't get smaller diameter spiders?
That's a good question. I don't know.
I mean, there's like 6 inches between the shaft and where the spider hits on the column.
The key issue that Dan projects about wall number three is we have that 100 foot of reduction of smaller pipe with no reduction.
Right.
And I think that's crucial.
Where's well three at?
Up
by the swimming pool.
Lance Park Road.
Oh.
One of the two towers.
So has Snyder done anything like that before? Has he made comments from them at all, or they probably haven't heard this yet?
I don't know.
We didn't get into those specifics today.
One issue with coming back next week is it's a workshop, and there aren't decisions in workshops. So then we'd be out another week for a firm decision. Of course, you could give the mayor some latitude tonight if you wanted, some discretion up to a dollar amount, depending on the presentation next week, so we don't lose another week.
Can we just continue the meeting till next week?
Yes.
Could we call a special meeting for that?
You could, absolutely.
Could only deal with that one thing.
Yep.
For X amount of time, and then go into your, to your workshop.
We could have the presentation on the workshop Tuesday, and then have a council meeting Wednesday, a special meeting. If that's what you want to do.
I thought in the past we've had, at the end of the meetings, where we actually called a council meeting, we voted on stuff. Haven't we done that before, Mark?
Well, we did it once, and what we did was declared an exception to the rule, and we did it several years ago, you're right.
Yeah, but can't we continue this or call a special meeting next Tuesday from 7 to 7:30 and resolve this issue, then start the workshop? Can you go that way?
Well, you've already identified in the ordinance remember there are only two kinds of meetings, regular and special. So the workshop is really a regular meeting. And I think, just for my two cents, I think we ought to allow yourself the option to make decisions in a meeting. It's a workshop unless you declare it a meeting ahead that you want to vote. But yes, you can do that, Mark.
Because we have to advertise, right? So we have to declare the meeting, so it's advertised?
No, it's already advertised. It's in the ordinance. It's published.
Okay.
But the workshop is not a special meeting.
But the issue is that the agenda is published and the public knows what's on the agenda. Mm-hmm. The agenda would be published for the workshop meeting.
So does the council want to have?
You still should be able to call a special meeting like at 6:30 before the.
Oh, you could.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We can do that.
Before
oh, yeah.
The
you
could. Workshop. Because the workshop is at 7:00.
Sure.
Yeah. So you can kill it off between 6:30 and yeah. 7 and then go into your workshop and be done.
Is that what the council wants to do?
Yeah.
6:30?
The 7 is 7:00 our meeting?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I guess we're doing 6:30.
6 or 6:15. Well, that way you can publish both
we'll,
the agendas.
We'll get it put together.
Okay.
That's Tuesday.
Tuesday. The 6th. Correct. Yep, thank you guys. Emerald Data Solutions, Board Docs Agreement. Eamon?
This is the one presentation we should have a PowerPoint and your computers because that's what we're talking about, but we don't have that ready tonight. You received some very basic brief training from Board docs relative to what a paperless agenda would be like. You have approved the expenditure of computers for yourself for that purpose. The contract before you is one that we're asking you allow the mayor or his representative to sign. It's a one-year contract, and it is has a termination of a one-year notice. The financial fee to this is a $1,000 what's called a non-recurring charge, which is basically a training fee. They send people here to train staff. Then it has a $2,700 annual recurring fee, which is billed on a monthly basis. Those of us that are over 50, this is a little bit tough to swallow for some of us after having talked to a couple of board members or council members today. Yeah, we're kind of pushing and pulling you into the air of computers. And those of you that visit me in my office know I write everything. I don't do it on computers. I still write everything and the secretary types it. But I do believe this is the future of Othello. It puts us in the forefront. It frees up staff time. And as Dan, I think you said you calculated it to $4 a person per month or something. Oh, Ken, I'm sorry. So yeah, it's probably true. It's about $35 a month savings. So about $4 a person. We're asking that you have taken two small steps towards a paperless document, and this doesn't have to be totally paperless. All you have to do is when you receive everything in your computer, you press print, and you can have whatever you want in paper. So you can have it either way. So we're asking that you approve the, allow the mayor or his designee to sign the service agreement with Board Docs, which is actually Emerald Data Solutions.
Questions?
So this would eliminate the staff putting any kind of packet together.
going around and around the table, putting all the packets together, yes.
So I hear a motion to authorize the mayor or his delegate to sign the agreement with Board Docs.
I'll make that motion.
Second.
Okay, Dan, any more discussion?
Got one question, I guess. What do you do with the public input or whatever? Do you still go ahead and print those out, or what do you do in a case like that?
Well,
give each one of them laptops.
Yeah, do you want to approve the expenditure for 30 chairs? We could do that. We normally have, I think, what, five in the back, two in the back. Thank you. Limited quantity in the backs. We could print that.
I would just caution council when you get into things like saving $190 in staff time. We had efficiency experts out of work, and they said, you know, if we didn't do this, we'd save staff time. Well, if you keep the current staff and they keep doing the current duties, you keep paying the current amount, you haven't saved anything. The theory is that you look down the road and you don't need to as quickly add staff as the town grows and we get busier. So the staff saving can be kind of a slippery slope for a while.
That's true. Just like the police department, when we grow, when we annex property to the city, the police department stays the same. At some point, we're going to need another officer. But you're right.
Yeah.
Where's that slippery slope at?
It's like when we quit dispatching the sheriff department. You know, we needed 1.5 people dispatched. Well, it's hard to have 0.5 people in a job. So you get into some fuzzy areas about whether you're really saving money there. But I totally endorse this. I think we got to get away from this piles of paper that we compile over there.
Thank you.
Okay, so do I move the motion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the same? Okay, great.
Thank you.
And just to complete that, when it comes to budget time and they want to add another person, I'll be bringing that up, that, hey, we should have extra time because we don't make packets anymore.
And you should. And you should.
That's kind of the thought with those $4.38. That's just that portion. That doesn't include the cost that we have. So
yeah.
You're behind. You're behind on the $260 a month.
Okay, council email policy. Debbie?
This is the proposed policy and procedure for council email, and our city attorney, Mr. Whitaker, reviewed the proposed policy at the last council meeting. In section 4.4, it provides for a process for the elected officials to bring the city laptops to City Hall for our IT staff to back up and archive your emails. That will become the city's records management process for your emails that you generate or receive. For now, we just caution you to not delete any emails until that process is in place. Communications that are made or received in connection with a transaction of public business are public records, and that includes any correspondence, email, social networking postings, forms, and comments. And these are all subject to public disclosures unless they are found to be exempt by state statute. Any deletion of any public records which have not been made a part of the city's records management system may be illegal. So that's why we caution you, don't delete them, let the IT archive them. All communication by elected officials, with a few exceptions, will be retained for 2 years, and staff will arrange for appraisal by the Washington State Archives prior to recording and deleting those emails. Section 4.7 is in regards to generating or reading substantial email concerning land use appeals that may be brought before the council. If you were to receive an email regarding a land use issue, prior to reviewing that email, that should be routed to the city administrator. A determination will be made by the city administrator and the attorney whether the email or parts of the email will be presented during the hearing if that is brought before the council. Okay.
How do you know if you didn't review it?
I know. That's a good question.
You'll probably know pretty quickly.
Okay.
Once you start reading it.
All right.
Yep.
I have the blinders on.
Yeah.
That is a good question, though.
It is.
The The policy explains exactly what is considered a public record, which can be made, which can be any type of writing or any form of communication relating to the conduct of government. See section 5.4 regarding
so
that.
So any junk email, obviously junk email, we can get rid of.
Obvious junk email.
Yes.
Like, you know, from Kenya.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
UPS has a package for you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Spam. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes.
That's because they had a whole bunch of that on there.
Yep. Yeah. Any emails?
I think I just classified it as junk.
Okay. You can just bring them over to those, the little files on the side.
But we can delete those.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, too, is it okay for them to delete emails that is just a... regarding a meeting coming up.
Right,
just
if it's something about you want to have lunch, I'll see you at the meeting, personal things like that, those are fine to delete.
Yeah.
Those aren't conducting city business, but it's, I'll see you for lunch to discuss the agenda, that's a public record.
Yeah.
Just be very cautious on it. So we recommend that you read the policy, understand the policy, ask questions as we go along with this process. At this time, we do recommend approval of the policy, and then again, you'll receive more information relevant to the IT employee archiving and backing up your city laptop. Are there any questions about the policy that either I or the city attorney can address?
No? Okay, so do I hear a motion to approve the council email policy?
That motion.
Ken Johnson? Okay.
Second. Either one.
Charles, see, you got a second then. All right, any more discussion? Questions? Nope. Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
The same? Opposed? Okay. That passes then. Okay, Councilmember Johnson's proposed ordinance review. Whitaker?
I only had a couple of comments. Sections 0.030 through 0.060 relate to the operation of a municipal court. Othello has not had a municipal criminal court available to it for over 15 years. And if you wanted to have that in connection with an ordinance similar to this Union Gap ordinance, it would require the recreation of a municipal court, which would require public defenders, paying for juries, and arranging a different arrangement with the county over paying for the judge's time. So, having a criminal court is something I encourage you to think hard about whether or not you really want to do it. Essentially, they're duplicating what are already state laws. So if you can just get the prosecutor to enforce the state laws, you'll get to pretty much the same place. Section 070, I suggested that you think about amending 826.030 of the OMC, which is where you have a big long list of what's a nuisance in town. And I suggest you add two things to that list. And one of them is permitting a violation of RCW 59-18-510 to occur in any rental dwelling unit. That is a provision of the Landlord-Tenant Act that provides a mechanism for any adjoining landowner or affected landowner, which is anyone who owns land within 100 feet of a rental unit, which, mysteriously, the city owns land within 100 feet of every rental unit because they have streets. to put the landlord on notice that they have a person who is engaged in gang activity living in a rental unit and they are to evict them, which is a provision of state law. This is a provision we have used in two other jurisdictions on more than one occasion. We like it a lot. The other one is to simply, much the same as is set forth in the Union Gap ordinance, repeat the definition about the criminal street gang activity and provide that you're not going to allow that to go on, you're not going to allow that to cause violations of the Uniform Housing Code or the State Uniform Housing Code or the Uniform Code for the Abatement of Dangerous Buildings, and anybody who goes upon property and commits criminal street gang activity with the owner's knowledge or consent, so they don't have to, they just have to know what's going on, is a nuisance and is grounds for revocation of any permit or license related to the use of that property. This is primarily if you get a business that starts to become a hangout for these people. We have not had to use this in another jurisdiction. We have threatened a business with this provision, and mysteriously, who hung around the business changed quickly after that came about. But the reason I encourage you to think about adding those kinds of provisions to 826030 is that through your administrative enforcement process you've adopted, remember, once we send them the notice and they're on notice, they need to comply, and if they don't comply, they run up a penalty of $250 a day until they reach $5,000. And every day they do it is a continuing violation. So if the first notice doesn't get their attention, a second notice can go out. And one thing we've learned in the other two jurisdictions that have used the part about rental units, landlords are not in the business to lose money. We have found that they tend to be in the business to make money. And so when threatened with the loss of money, they tend to figure out a way to relieve the neighborhood of the undesirable tenants, so long as we have the proof that they are undesirable tenants. Then I would note that section 090 is problematic. Some of you were on the council when Othello had a parental responsibility ordinance, which mistakenly sometimes got referred to as a curfew ordinance, probably because it required parents to be responsible for their children's whereabouts at certain hours of the night. That ordinance was based on a provision in the Washington State Code that relates to dependent children and expounded on that. Unfortunately, that is the kind of ordinance that was found constitutionally vague in the Sumner case about 4 years ago by the state Supreme Court. And this Union Gap case attempts to impose a penalty on parents because their children have committed a crime. That's a very different situation than saying you have to know where your kid is because you're a parent and you're responsible for them. The law does not favor vicarious liability as a general rule. You have to find special circumstances for me to be responsible for Eamon shoplifting. And it's really not much different even if they're your children. Because if your children have committed a crime, the parents can be made already under a state law to pay restitution for damages. But to impose a penalty just because your children commits a crime, I would advise the council not to adopt a provision like that until we get a ruling out of some appellate court in this state on whether or not the appellate courts are going to allow that to stand. I have a real strong suspicion they will not if somebody actually takes this to an appellate court and asks those appellate judges, because it gets into making someone responsible for the acts, the criminal acts of others, which are by their definition intentional acts. And it's very hard to make me responsible for the intentional acts of another person. And I would really urge caution there. So those were my comments on the ordinance.
Could the sections when it talks about municipal courts, could that be just changed to Adams County Municipal Courts, because that's who we deal through?
Well, no. The problem is that the court would be enforcing a city law, and that has to happen in the municipal department of the district court. So it's our municipal court. So all of the trappings related to that criminal prosecution, the public defenders, prosecutors, juries, all of those elements become the city's expense.
Well, how does it work with our current OMCs when somebody's...
But none of those are crimes.
None of those
are crimes. Okay. About 15 years ago, the city decriminalized that the only things that the chief's people enforce that are OMCs anymore are infractions. And that was part of the deal we made with the county, essentially, is that they got the crimes, good, bad, and indifferent, and they got the money. So they get the state traffic stuff, which makes money, but they also get the state criminal stuff, which loses money. So, and in fact, that ran into such a deficit, I guess we don't have anyone left on the council who negotiated the agreement we have that supplements the amount, is that $50,000 a year? The city pays the county an additional $50,000 a year towards the prosecution of criminal cases committed basically in the city, and that was because of the criminal load was far outstripping the money from the traffic infraction revenues, and it was essentially to get a prosecutor down here in the panhandle.
In the area. I was on council on
that. That was Ken was on that. Okay. But I know that, but I remember, I think it was
Everett,
I believe, actually yes. negotiated the contract. But anyway, though that's the issue that comes up with the crimes is that it opens up the city. Well, yeah, if you're going to pay for all that, then you might want to start having city crimes again. Well, now you're starting to go backwards on the agreement you made with the county 15 years ago on how you divide things up. I mean, it's not quite as simple as it sounds. And it can become expensive.
So basically, though, that could be cleaned up pretty easily in the existing ordinance that I had.
Well, I believe that I would encourage the council, if they're interested, to add those new nuances to your code.
To take
because
care of
they're there. They're not just there okay. for the code enforcement officer. They're there for the chief to use because probably the chief in our other jurisdictions, the chief is the one who deals with these gang issues, not a code enforcement officer. Yeah.
Okay, and the last issue is the parents.
Yeah, the 090, where they actually allow the city to fine, in fact, penalize the parents for the criminal conduct of their children, which is different than making them responsible, as state law allows, to recover damages. I really encourage the council to stay away from that until somebody gets that in the Court of Appeals and finds out who's going to be right and who's. I'd hate to have you be the test case, you know. Everybody can talk about that Othello case that turned it bad. But.
So we'd have to strike that 0.90 out of the.
I would encourage you to go ahead and take that out. And I think that really by putting the what's in section 070 into the other part, it gets you the best part of that ordinance into your existing scheme. That would be my recommendation, but of course the council can do whatever you want.
In the Tri-City Herald, once in a while I'll read about a kid got caught at 3 a.m. with graffiti, and it says the parent was also charged with, but it might...
Okay, they are probably using the Auburn ordinance, which I shared with the chief. We also discussed the curfew issue. After the Sumner case, some cities attempted to cure the constitutional vagueness of the parental responsibility ordinance. And Dan Hyde, a friend of mine in Auburn, who's a good lawyer, did that for Auburn. And if you want to talk about having something like that, I would encourage you to look at the Auburn example. Now, the drawback to the Auburn example to get around the vagueness problem is, as the chief noted right away, you basically, okay, in the Sumner case, the parent was cited because the child was at the mini market at midnight without the parent present. Well, the court found it vague because what did it mean to remain unlawfully? That wasn't defined. How would a person of ordinary understanding know what that meant? I thought it was pretty clear. But the Court of Appeals in Division 2 decided it wasn't very clear. And they said that a person of ordinary understanding wouldn't know what it meant to remain. Well, basically, the Auburn ordinance gets it down when the officer shows up and tells them they're not supposed to be there. Now they're remaining unlawfully. So, I think, I haven't talked to Dan, so I don't know, and I don't know if the chief talked to anybody from Auburn either, but he speculated, and I think he's correct, that essentially what happens is that when you have these people out and found, essentially what you're going to do is call up the parents to come and get them. Because you're really not in a position to cite the parent until the child has been there unlawfully, has remained unlawfully. I think Dan's definition cures the vagueness problem,
But from a practical point of view, I don't know how effective it is. I would suggest if the council had, I mean, if you're interested in a hours kind of containment thing, I'd say look at Auburn's example. I think they're the best example in the state to look at. But I'd also probably suggest someone talk to the Auburn PD and find out how well it works. I mean, to have it and not have it be very effective, I don't know that that does you much good.
So is there any action we can take now in Othello if a teenager's wandering around at 3 a.m.?
Unless they're committing a crime. No, you may not in Washington Seattle versus Pullman.
How about when I referenced the Tri-City Herald, it seems like that was like they cited the kid and the parent. It was in like Hermiston in Oregon. Is it different in...
Yes. Oregon has a different... Oregon, well, everybody can do it different. In this state, Tacoma has a very different juvenile curfew ordinance than everyone else. It is based on a Dallas, Texas ordinance that was found to be valid by the Fifth Circuit. Don't you remember that number? Five. And that happened a few years back, some years back now. Well, not that many years ago in the Ninth Circuit, where we live, in a case called San Diego versus Duns, the Ninth Circuit came out with a holding 180 degrees from what the Fifth Circuit came out and ruled that San Diego's juvenile curfew was completely unconstitutional. Violated the federal constitution, didn't even get into the California constitution. In Washington, under the Pullman case, our problem is the Washington constitution, not the federal constitution. So that's one of the reasons Oregon is going to be different, because their state constitution is different than ours. So they're probably using a federal standard.
My intent and what I'd really like to see it do is hold these parents that are responsible that their kids are knowingly going out there and doing criminal activity, that have been not just caught once, but three, four, five times, and their parents have had to come and pick them up but not held accountable or responsible for it.
See, I would suggest that you go back and look at sections 030 through 036 or even 090, but probably more in the 030 to 06 area, and rewrite one of those sections and provide that the parents are responsible for the cost of cleanup. I would encourage that be, because that is provided for in state law. Start making the parents responsible for the tortious, because remember, every crime is also a tort. It's also a breach of a duty owed. So there's a right to make a claim for the cost of remediation.
If you look at this here, only 11 known under that are juveniles. All the rest of them are not juveniles.
Well, they're either not juveniles or, I suspect, the chief does not have sufficient criminal data background to make the classification, correct, Chief?
We have sufficient for the ones that we have classified. We know that there are others who associate, but until they meet that strict classification category, we're not going to label them as a gang. By law, we shouldn't be doing that. In addition, once we do, then we have to offer due process. They have a right to a hearing to be able to come in and have my ruling gotten away with based on what evidence they meant to bring to the table. The thing about parents has been a constant theme from citizens to police to council. And recently I sent a letter to our prosecutor, Randy Flick. I've had conversations with Juan Barber from Juvenile. Currently, the way probation for the juveniles is handled is the probation officers load up all of the kids and then take them up to Risville. And the parents are not required or don't come to court because that's a long trip. So what I proposed, what I suggested, is that we start having the court come here once a month and have our juvenile hearings here in our own community where these kids live. And then their parents can come to these meetings and probation and therefore become an active part
that is what we're looking at to try to improve the probationary conditions and the supervision after the child is caught breaking some law and actually goes on to probation, which is the system that they use after adjudication. So there are people that are working on those concerns. So I don't want you to think that they're on, but we're looking at all of those different avenues.
Can a condition of probation limit their hours out on the street?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it does.
Okay.
When they sign a conditions of probation now with the juvenile department, they are required to be home in bed by 9 o'clock. Well, they're supposed to be home by 9.
So if they're out wandering around at 3 a.m., we can pick them up for violating probation?
No. We can stop them, identify them, talk to them, and then we can call a probation officer and say, we've located Jimmy Schwartz, he's out, he's passed his curfew, what would you like to do with him?
Okay.
Most of the time they'll say send him home. A probation violation is something that they'll address in court. They don't usually pick him up and take him to Martin Hall, which is the juvenile jail in Spokane.
Okay.
If we caught him breaking a new law, something that they were doing, then we would call him up, and chances are that they would probably go to Martin Hall. But it would again depend on the crime.
So I guess one of the questions I would have, would you like us to bring something to the council for, especially on this one issue, about bringing court down here once a month? Would the council be interested in signing something, maybe like a petition or something, I don't know what it'd be called, that could be written up, requesting that court be down here once a month, you know, from the judicial system up north? You know, have it brought down here. It used to be down here, from what I understood, one time a month, but, you know, showing support for that down here. That's something the council would like to see in the next 2 weeks, I guess, from now, the meeting?
I think that'd be a good move to start.
Start in the way.
Okay, I guess we'll get something drawn up then for,
cost us.
You know, show support for that, so.
Yeah, sure.
What's that? Oh, Sean, you have a question?
I have a question. Do you think once a month is enough, based on population in Adams County and based on the high concentration of population here in the Panhandle and based on the number of cases to deal with, do you think once a month is enough?
Well, I'd say that's a good starting point. If we ask too much, they may not move. So, you know what I mean, as far as getting them down here? What do you think, Steve?
Once a month is all they do in Ritzville right now, and
oh,
it's probably adequate. You have to remember that these kids have already been charged, they've been adjudicated, and now they're on probation. So as long as they're following probation, they come to court once in a while and check in. There's, 30-some kids right now that are on probation supervision out of our area. That's a ballpark figure. So, yeah, once a month would probably be okay, because once a month there might only need to be 8 or 10 of those children coming in to review their case status, see how they're doing, and make whatever appearance the judge feels they need to make, because they're not all due every month in the same court at the same time.
Oh, okay.
So,
yeah, you bet.
Good. Okay, then I guess we'll get something put up and brought before the council. Assume we have to vote on it?
We'll put something together for next week.
Oh, okay.
So to consider.
Okay. And I guess, Ken, you're going to continue working on this?
I'm going to continue working on the changes. I was hoping to get some good public input on Thursday night to see what the public has to say about it, too. And then we'll go from there. And hopefully we can have something put together for the next meeting.
Any other questions, comments?
I would just be interested in pursuing that Auburn law. Anything that you can contact kids on the streets at these ridiculous hours and have some kind of repercussion, that I would think that should be pursued.
We can also bring you a new parental responsibility ordinance modeled on the Auburn.
Yeah.
One.
That was a lot of people's concerns talking to me when they were finding about this ordinance was keep parents responsible for their kids. That was, I think, the most talked about.
Well, and I think the before the Sumner case, the parental responsibility law that Mick and I put together worked pretty well. It gave police a means to talk to them. I heard from several police departments that they felt it really cut down on the tagging and that kind of stuff from the middle school type kids acting out, nothing to do in the summertime. And that's why we were at the city attorney's conference when it first came out that Sumner had lost in Division II. We were disappointed. And then when the Supreme Court just perfunctorily sustained, we didn't have much choice because the ACLU sent letters out to most cities saying, if you have the Sumner parental responsibility ordinance, we expect you to repeal it. Otherwise, we put you on notice if we get a claim in your community. So I went around to all my cities and we repealed them.
Steve?
I just wanted to make something clear. Kids out at 3 o'clock in the morning don't get ignored. They're going to be contacted by the police. The difference is, comes where they're actually in control of the meeting. If they say, you know, and they want to talk, yeah, I'm so-and-so, yeah, I just got done playing video games and I'm on my way home, they can do that. If they choose to, without reasonable suspicion that they've committed a crime or about to commit, I mean, if they're carrying a spray paint can, that gives us reasonable suspicion to go ahead and force them to have a conversation with us. But if they're just out there at 3 o'clock in the morning, they're going to get contacted, I guarantee you, if an officer sees them, to find out who they are, what they're doing, and if they need a ride home, if there's a problem. That's part of our caretaking of our community for kids and everybody else that's concerned. But if they actually want to draw a line in the sand and say, I'm not doing anything and I don't have to talk to you, then without that reasonable suspicion that they are up to no good, they're in fact right. They don't have to talk to us. But chances are they're going to at least see you talk and say, and at least have some conversation. So as long as they're willing to a social contact, we can talk to them all we want, but they will get contact. It's whether or not they have the authority to force them to give up information. That's the key question.
Any other things, counsel, on that issue? Okay. Unfinished business. New business. Okay. Mayor's announcements. One thing for Larry and Taylor, does the council mind when they're done presenting if they leave? If you guys want to leave after presenting instead of sitting here, I know you got an hour and a half drive, I don't know what it is, but you know, I want you to feel free. You know, you've done what we've asked, and you know, go ahead and feel free just to get up and leave. So okay, well, I just don't want you to feel like you gotta sit here till the meeting's over and drive your hour and a half, 2 hours to get home. So
I had to make sure that what hour I had to get Taylor home by also.
Oh, there you go.
Just be sure you know when you put it on the bill in.
Yeah. We're looking forward to that day when you get your office set up here in town somewhere. We've been giving you enough business. Okay, mayor announcements. Tomorrow night, Tuesday, the 29th, is the second Main Street Community Forum. The meeting is at 6 p.m. here in City Hall. There was approximately 25 businesses or people represented at the last meeting, which was last Tuesday. Also, this Thursday night at McFarland Junior High Auditorium, there's a community forum related to gangs in Othello. We have a panel of 7 to report and respond to questions. So we'd love to see some of you there. Next Monday is a holiday, therefore the council meeting will be on Tuesday the 6th. I guess it's 6:30 now. So everybody remember that. And then Stan will have open time to help council members with their computers. That's tomorrow. So you can drop anywhere between 9 and 10:30 or 1:30 to 3:30. So if you need help with that. And is there anything else anybody can think of before we adjourn the meeting?
No.
Okay, meeting's adjourned. Thank you, everybody. That's great.
Guess that one, right?
They do monitor this.